Precisely what the Goodrich secrets are is not spelled out in the order, and therefore I have acted as if all the things they allege to be secrets actually are secrets, he said. Nevertheless, my efficiency is not impaired by my avoiding disclosure of those things. Take, for example, the use of polyurethane as an inner liner, a process that Goodrich claimed as a trade secret. That was something Latex had tried previously and found unsatisfactory. Therefore, it wasn't planning to investigate further along those lines. And it still isn't. I am just as effective for Latex as if there had never been an injunction. However, I will say this. If I were to get a better offer from some other company now, I'm sure I would evaluate the question very carefully, which is what I didn't do the last time. Wolgamuth, the new post-trial Wolgamuth, spoke in a noticeably slow, tense way, with long pauses for thought, as if the wrong word might bring lightning down on his head. He was a young man with a strong sense of belonging to the future, and he looked forward to making, if he could, a material contribution to putting man on the moon. At the same time, Jeter may have been right. He was also a man who had recently spent almost 6 months in the toils of the law, and who worked, and would continue to work, in the knowledge that a slip of the tongue might mean a fine, imprisonment, and professional ruin. Chapter 12. In Defense of Sterling. 1. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York stands on the block bounded by Liberty, Nassau, and William Streets, and Maiden Lane, on the slope of one of the few noticeable hillocks remaining in the bulldozed, skyscraper-flattened earth of downtown Manhattan. Its entrance faces Liberty, and its mien is dignified and grim. Its arched ground-floor windows, designed in imitation of those of the Pitti and Riccardi palaces in Florence, are protected by iron grills made of bars as thick as a boy's wrist, and above them are rows of small rectangular windows set in a bluff-like 14-story wall of sandstone and limestone, the blocks of which once varied in color from brown through gray to blue, but which soot has reduced to a common gray. The facade's austerity is relieved only at the level of the 12th floor, by a Florentine loggia. Two giant iron lanterns, near replicas of lanterns that adorn the Strozzi Palace in Florence, flank the main entrance. But they seem to be there less to please or illuminate the entrant than to intimidate him. Nor is the building's interior much more cheery or hospitable. The ground floor features cavernous groin vaulting and high ironwork partitions in intricate geometric floral and animal designs, and it is guarded by hordes of bank security men, whose dark blue uniforms make them look much like policemen. Huge and dour as it is, the Federal Reserve Bank, as a building, arouses varied feelings in its beholders. To admirers of the debonair new Chase Manhattan Bank across Liberty Street, which is notable for huge windows, bright colored tile walls, and stylish abstract expressionist paintings, it is an epitome of 19th century heavy-footedness in bank architecture, even though it was actually completed in 1924. To an awestruck writer for the magazine Architecture in 1927, it seemed as inviolable as the Rock of Gibraltar and no less inspiring of one's reverent obeisance, and possessed of a quality which, for lack of a better word, I can best describe as epic. To the mothers of young girls who work in it as secretaries or pages, it looks like a particularly sinister sort of prison. Bank robbers are apparently equally respectful of its inviolability. There has never been the slightest hint of an attempt on it. To the Municipal Art Society of New York, which now rates it as a full-fledged landmark, it was until 1967 only a second-class landmark, being assigned to Category 2, structures of great local or regional importance which should be preserved, rather than Category 1, structures of national importance which should be preserved at all costs. On the other hand, it has one indisputable edge on the Pitti, Riccardi, and Strozzi palaces. It is bigger than any of them. In fact, it is a bigger Florentine palace than has ever stood in Florence. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York is set apart from the other banks of Wall Street in purpose and function as well as in appearance. As by far the largest and most important of the 12 regional Federal Reserve Banks, which together with the Federal Reserve Board in Washington and the 6,200 commercial banks that are members make up the Federal Reserve System, it is the chief operating arm of the United States central banking institution. Most other countries have only one central bank, the Bank of England, the Bank of France, and so on, rather than a network of such banks, but the central banks of all countries have the same dual purpose: to keep the national currency in a healthy state by regulating its supply, partly through the degree of ease or difficulty with which it may be borrowed, and, when necessary, to defend its value in relation to that of other national currencies. To accomplish the first objective, the New York Bank cooperates with its parent board and its 11 brother banks in periodically adjusting a number of monetary throttles, of which the most visible, although not necessarily most important, is the rate of interest at which it lends money to other banks. As to the second objective, by virtue of tradition and of its situation in the nation's and the world's greatest financial center, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York is the sole agent of the Federal Reserve System and of the United States Treasury in dealings with other countries. Thus, on its shoulders falls the chief responsibility for operations in defense of the dollar. Those responsibilities were weighing heavily during the great monetary crisis of 1968, and indeed, since the defense of the dollar sometimes involves the defense of other currencies as well, over the preceding 3.5 years. Charged as it is with acting in the national interest, in fact having no other purpose, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, together with its brother banks, obviously is an arm of government. Yet it has a foot in the free enterprise camp. In what some might call characteristic American fashion, it stands squarely astride the chalk line between government and business. Although it functions as a government agency, its stock is privately owned by the member banks throughout the country, to which it pays annual dividends, limited by law to 6% per year. Although its top officers take a federal oath, they are not appointed by the President of the United States, or even by the Federal Reserve Board, but are elected by the bank's own board of directors, and their salaries are paid not out of the federal till, but out of the bank's own income. Yet that income, though happily always forthcoming, is entirely incidental to the bank's purpose, and if it rises above expenses and dividends, the excess is automatically paid into the United States Treasury. A bank that considers profits incidental is scarcely the norm in Wall Street, and this attitude puts Federal Reserve Bank men in a uniquely advantageous social position. Because their bank is a bank, after all, and a privately owned, profitable one at that, they can't be dismissed as mere government bureaucrats. Conversely, having their gaze fixed steadily above the mire of cupidity entitles them to be called the intellectuals, if not actually the aristocrats of Wall Street banking. Under them lies gold, still the bedrock on which all money nominally rests, though in recent times a bedrock that has been shuddering ominously under the force of various monetary earthquakes. As of March 1968, more than 13,000 tons of the stuff, worth more than $13 billion, and amounting to more than a quarter of all the monetary gold in the free world, reposed on actual bedrock, 76 feet below Liberty Street level and 50 below sea level, in a vault that would be inundated if a system of sump pumps did not divert a stream that originally wandered through Maiden Lane. The famous 19th century British economist, Walter Bagehot, once told a friend that when his spirits were low, it used to cheer him to go down to his bank and dabble my hand in a heap of sovereigns. Although it is, to say the least, a stimulating experience to go down and look at the gold in the Federal Reserve Bank vault, which is in the form not of sovereigns, but of dully gleaming bars about the size and shape of building bricks, not even the best accredited visitor is allowed to dabble his hands in it. For one thing, the bars weigh about 28 pounds each, and are therefore ill-adapted to dabbling, and for another, none of the gold belongs to either the Federal Reserve Bank or the United States. All United States gold is kept at Fort Knox, at the New York Assay Office, or at the various mints. The gold deposited at the Federal Reserve Bank belongs to some 70 other countries, the largest depositors being European, which find it convenient to store a good part of their gold reserves there. Originally, most of them put gold there for safekeeping during the Second World War. After the war, the European nations, with the exception of France, not only left it in New York, but greatly increased its quantity as their economies recovered. Nor does the gold represent anything like all the foreign deposits at Liberty Street. Investments of various sorts brought the March 68 total to more than $28 billion. As a banker for most of the central banks of the non-communist world, and as the central bank representing the world's leading currency, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York is the undisputed chief citadel of world currency. By virtue of this position, it is afforded a kind of fluoroscopic vision of the insides of international finance, enabling it to detect at a glance an incipiently diseased currency here, a faltering economy there. If, for example, Great Britain is running a deficit in her foreign dealings, this instantly shows up in the Federal Reserve Bank's books in the form of a decline in the Bank of England's balance. In the fall of 1964, precisely such a decline was occurring, and it marked the beginning of a long, gallant, intermittently hair-raising, and ultimately losing struggle by a number of countries and their central banks, led by the United States and the Federal Reserve, to safeguard the existing order of world finance by preserving the integrity of the pound sterling. One trouble with imposing buildings is that they have a tendency to belittle the people and activities they enclose, and most of the time it is reasonably accurate to think of the Federal Reserve Bank as a place where often bored people push around workaday slips of paper, quite similar to those pushed around in other banks. But since 1964, some of the events there, if they have scarcely been capable of inspiring reverent obeisance, have had a certain epic quality. Early in 1964, it began to be clear that Britain, which for several years had maintained an approximate equilibrium in her international balance of payments, that is, the amount of money she had annually sent outside her borders had been about equal to the amount she had taken in, was running a substantial deficit. Far from being the result of domestic depression in Britain, this situation was the result of over-exuberant domestic expansion. Business was booming, and newly affluent Britons were ordering bales and bales of costly goods from abroad without increasing the exports of British goods on anything like the same scale. In short, Britain was living beyond her means. A substantial balance of payments deficit is a worry to a relatively self-sufficient country like the United States. Indeed, the United States was having that very worry at that very time, and it would for years to come. But to a trading nation like Britain, about a quarter of whose entire economy is dependent on foreign trade, it constitutes a grave danger. The situation was cause for growing concern at the Federal Reserve Bank, and the focal point of the concern was the office on the 10th floor of Charles A. Coombs, the bank's vice president in charge of foreign operations. All summer long, the fluoroscope showed a sick and worsening pound sterling. From the research section of the Foreign Department, Coombs daily got reports that a torrent of money was leaving Britain. From underground, word rose that the pile of gold bars in the locker assigned to Britain was shrinking appreciably. Not through any foul play in the vault, but because so many of the bars were being transferred to other lockers in settlement of Britain's international debts. From the Foreign Exchange Trading Desk, on the seventh floor, the news almost every afternoon was that the open market quotations on the pound, in terms of dollars, had sunk again that day. During July and August, as the quotation dropped from $2.79 to $2.78.91, and then to $2.78.75, the situation was regarded on Liberty Street as so serious that Coombs, who would normally handle foreign exchange matters himself, only making routine reports to those higher up, was constantly conferring about it with his boss, the Federal Reserve Bank's president, a tall, cool, soft-spoken man named Alfred Hayes. Mystifyingly complex though it may appear, what actually happens in international financial dealings is essentially what happens in private domestic transactions. The money worries of a nation, like those of a family, are the consequence of having too much money go out and not enough come in. The foreign sellers of goods to Britain cannot spend the pounds they are paid in their own countries, and therefore they convert them into their own currencies. This they do by selling the pounds in the foreign exchange markets, just as if they were selling securities on a stock exchange. The market price of the pound fluctuates in response to supply and demand, and so do the prices of all other currencies, all that is except the dollar, the sun in the planetary system of currencies, inasmuch as the United States has, since 1934, stood pledged to exchange gold in any quantity for dollars at the pleasure of any nation at the fixed price of $35 per ounce. Under the pressure of selling, the price of the pound goes down, but its fluctuations are severely restricted. The influence of market forces cannot be allowed to lower or raise the price more than a couple of cents below or above the pound's par value. If such wild swings should occur unchecked, bankers and businessmen everywhere who traded with Britain would find themselves involuntarily engaged in a kind of roulette game and would be inclined to stop trading with Britain. Accordingly, under international monetary rules agreed upon at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire in 1944 and elaborated at various other places at later times, the pound in 1964, nominally valued at $2.80, was allowed to fluctuate only between $2.78 and $2.82. And the enforcer of this abridgment of the law of supply and demand was the Bank of England. On a day when things were going smoothly, the pound might be quoted on the exchange markets at, say, $2.79.91, a rise of 0.15 cents from the previous day's closing. 0.15 cents doesn't sound like much, but on a round $1 million, which is generally the basic unit in international monetary dealings, it amounts to $1,500. When that happened, the Bank of England needed to do nothing. If, however, the pound was strong in the markets and rose to $2.82, something it showed absolutely no tendency to do in 1964, the Bank of England was pledged to, and would have been very happy to, accept gold or dollars in exchange for pounds at that price, thereby preventing a further increase in the price and at the same time increasing its own reserve of gold and dollars, which serve as the pound's backing. If, on the other hand, and this was a more realistic hypothesis, the pound was weak and sank to $2.78, the Bank of England's sworn duty was to intervene in the market and buy, with gold or dollars, all pounds offered for sale at that price, however deeply this might have cut into its own reserves. Thus, the central bank of a spendthrift country, like the father of a spendthrift family, is eventually forced to pay the bills out of capital. But in times of serious currency weakness, the central bank loses even more of its reserves than this would suggest, because of the vagaries of market psychology. Prudent importers and exporters seeking to protect their capital and profits reduce to a minimum the sum they hold in pounds and the length of time they hold it. Currency speculators, whose noses have been trained to sniff out weakness, pounce on a falling pound and make enormous short sales, in the expectation of turning a profit on a further drop, and the Bank of England must absorb the speculative sales along with the straightforward ones. The ultimate consequence of unchecked currency weakness is something that may be incomparably more disastrous in its effects than family bankruptcy. This is devaluation, and devaluation of a key world currency like the pound is the recurrent nightmare of all central bankers, whether in London, New York, Frankfurt, Zurich, or Tokyo. If at any time the drain on Britain's reserves became so great that the Bank of England was unable or unwilling to fulfill its obligation to maintain the pound at $2.78, the necessary result would be devaluation. That is, the $2.78 to $2.82 limitation would be abruptly abrogated. By simple government decree, the par value of the pound would be reduced to some lower figure, and a new set of limits established around the new parity. The heart of the danger was the possibility that what followed might be chaos, not confined to Britain. Devaluation, as the most heroic and most dangerous of remedies for a sick currency, is rightly feared. By making the devaluing country's goods cheaper to others, it boosts exports, and thus reduces or eliminates a deficit in international accounts. But at the same time, it makes both imports and domestic goods more expensive at home, and thus reduces the country's standard of living. It is radical surgery, curing a disease at the expense of some of the patient's strength and well-being, and in many cases, some of his pride and prestige as well. Worst of all, if the devalued currency is one that, like the pound, is widely used in international dealings, the disease, or more precisely, the cure, is likely to prove contagious. To nations holding large amounts of that particular currency in their reserve vaults, the effects of the devaluation is the same as if the vaults had been burglarized. Such nations and others, finding themselves at an unacceptable trading disadvantage as a result of the devaluation, may have to resort to competitive devaluation of their own currencies. A downward spiral develops. Rumors of further devaluations are constantly in the wind. The loss of confidence in other people's money leads to a disinclination to do business across national borders, and international trade, upon which depend the food and shelter of hundreds of millions of people around the world, tends to decline. Just such a disaster followed the classic devaluation of all time, the departure of the pound from the old gold standard in 1931, an event that is still generally considered a major cause of the worldwide depression of the 30s. The process works similarly in respect to the currencies of all the 100-odd countries that are members of the International Monetary Fund, an organization that originated at Bretton Woods. For any country, a favorable balance of payments means an accumulation of dollars, either directly or indirectly, which are freely convertible into gold in the country's central bank. If the demand for its currency is great enough, the country may revalue it upward, the reverse of a devaluation, as both Germany and the Netherlands did in 1961. Conversely, an unfavorable balance of payments starts the sequence of events that may end in forced devaluation. The degree of disruption of world trade that devaluation of a currency causes depends on that currency's international importance. A large devaluation of the Indian rupee in June 1966, although it was a serious matter to India, created scarcely a ripple in the international markets. And, to round out this brief outline of the rules of an intricate game of which everybody everywhere is an inadvertent player, even the lordly dollar is far from immune to the effects of an unfavorable balance of payments or of speculation. Because of the dollar's pledged relation to gold, it serves as the standard for all other currencies, so its price does not fluctuate in the markets. However, it can suffer weakness of a less visible but equally ominous sort. When the United States sends out substantially more money, whether payment for imports, foreign aid, investments, loans, tourist expenses, or military costs, then it takes in. The recipients freely buy their own currencies with the newly acquired dollars, thereby raising the dollar prices of their own currencies. The rise in price enables their central banks to take in still more dollars, which they can sell back to the United States for gold. Thus, when the dollar is weak, the United States loses gold. France alone, a country with a strong currency and no particular official love of the dollar, required $30 million or more in United States gold regularly, every month for several years prior to the autumn of 1966. And between 1958, when the United States began running a serious deficit in its international accounts, and the middle of March 1968, our gold reserve was halved, from $22.8 billion to $11.4 billion. If the reserve ever dropped to an unacceptably low level, the United States would be forced to break its word and lower the gold value of the dollar, or even to stop selling gold entirely. Either action would, in effect, be a devaluation. The one devaluation, because of the dollar's preeminent position, that would be more disruptive to world monetary order than a devaluation of the pound. Hayes and Coombs, neither of whom is old enough to have experienced the events of 1931 at first hand as a banker, but both of whom are such diligent and sensitive students of international banking that they might as well have done so, found that, as the hot days of 1964 dragged on, they had occasion to be in almost daily contact by transatlantic telephone with their Bank of England counterparts, the Earl of Cromer, governor of the bank at that time, and Roy A.O. Bridge, the governor's advisor on foreign exchange. It became clear to them, from these conversations and from other sources, that the imbalance in Britain's international accounts was far from the whole trouble. A crisis of confidence in the soundness of the pound was developing, and the main cause of it seemed to be the election that Britain's conservative government was facing on October 15th. The one thing that international financial markets hate and fear above all others is uncertainty. Any election represents uncertainty, so the pound always has the jitters just before Britons go to the polls. But to the people who deal in currencies, this election looked particularly menacing, because of their estimate of the character of the Labour government that might come into power. The conservative financiers of London, not to mention those of continental Europe, looked with almost irrational suspicion on Harold Wilson, the Labour choice for Prime Minister. Further, some of Mr. Wilson's economic advisers had explicitly extolled the virtues of devaluation of the pound in their earlier theoretical writings. And finally, there was an all-too-pat analogy to be drawn from the fact that the last previous term of the British Labour Party in power had been conspicuously marked in 1949 by a devaluation of sterling from the rate of $4.03 to $2.80. In these circumstances, almost all the dealers in the world money markets, whether they were ordinary international businessmen or out-and-out currency speculators, were anxious to get rid of pounds, at least until after the election. Like all speculative attacks, this one fed on itself. Each small drop in the pound's price resulted in further loss of confidence, and down, down went the pound in the international markets. An oddly diffused sort of exchange, which does not operate in any central building, but rather is conducted by telephone and cable between the trading desks of banks in the world's major cities. Simultaneously, down, down went British reserves, as the Bank of England struggled to support the pound. Early in September, Hayes went to Tokyo for the annual meeting of the members of the International Monetary Fund. In the corridors of the building where participants in the fund met, he heard one European central banker after another express misgivings about the state of the British economy and the outlook for the British currency. Why didn't the British government take steps at home to check its outlay and to improve the balance of payments, they asked each other? Why didn't it raise the Bank of England's lending rate, the so-called bank rate, from its current 5%, since this move would have the effect of raising British interest rates all up and down the line, and would thus serve the double purpose of damping down domestic inflation and attracting investment dollars to London from other financial centers, with the result that sterling would gain a sounder footing. Doubtless the continental bankers also put such questions to the Bank of England men in Tokyo. In any event, the Bank of England men and their counterparts in the British Exchequer had not failed to put the questions to themselves. But the proposed measures would certainly be unpopular with the British electorate, as unmistakable harbingers of austerity, and the Conservative government, like many governments before it, appeared to be paralyzed by fear of the imminent election. So it did nothing. In a strictly monetary way, however, Britain did take defensive measures during September. The Bank of England had, for several years, had a standing agreement with the Federal Reserve that either institution could borrow $500 million from the other over a short term at any time with virtually no formalities. Now the Bank of England accepted this standby loan and made arrangements to supplement it with another $500 million in short-term credit from various European central banks and the Bank of Canada. This total of $1 billion, together with Britain's last-ditch reserves in gold and dollars, amounting to about $2.6 billion, constituted a sizable store of ammunition. If the speculative assault on the pound should continue or intensify, answering fire would come from the Bank of England in the form of dollar investments in sterling made on the battlefield of the free market, and presumably the attackers would be put to rout. As might have been expected, the assault did intensify after Labour came out the victor in the October election. The new British government realized at the outset that it was faced with a grave crisis, and that immediate and drastic action was in order. It has since been said that summary devaluation of the pound was seriously considered by the newly elected Prime Minister and his advisers on finance, George Brown, Secretary of State for Economic Affairs, and James Callaghan, Chancellor of the Exchequer. The idea was rejected, though, and the measures they actually took in October and early November were 15% emergency surcharge on British imports, in effect a blanket raising of tariffs, an increased fuel tax, and stiff new capital gains and corporation taxes. These were deflationary, currency-strengthening measures, to be sure, but the world markets were not reassured. The specific nature of the new taxes seems to have disconcerted and even enraged many financiers in and out of Britain, particularly in view of the fact that under the new budget, British government spending on welfare benefits was actually to be increased, rather than cut back, as deflationary policy would normally require. One way and another, then, the sellers, or bears in market jargon, continued to be in charge of the market for the pound in the weeks after the election, and the Bank of England was kept busy potting away at them with precious shells from its borrowed billion-dollar arsenal. By the end of October, nearly half the billion was gone, and the bears were still inexorably advancing on the pound, a hundredth of a cent at a time. Hayes, Coombs, and their foreign department colleagues on Liberty Street, watching with mounting anxiety, were as galled as the British by the fact that a central bank defending its currency against attack can have only the vaguest idea of where the attack is coming from. Speculation is inherent in foreign trade, and by its nature is almost impossible to isolate, identify, or even define. There are degrees of speculation. The word itself, like selfishness or greed, denotes a judgment. And yet every exchange of currencies might be called a speculation in favor of the currency being acquired and against the one being disposed of. At one end of the scale are perfectly legitimate business transactions that have specific speculative effects. A British importer ordering American merchandise may legitimately pay up in pounds in advance of delivery. If he does, he is speculating against the pound. An American importer who is contracted to pay for British goods at a price set in pounds may legitimately insist that his purchase of the pounds he needs to settle his debt be deferred for a certain period. He too is speculating against the pound. The staggering importance to Britain of these common commercial operations, which are called leads and lags, respectively, is shown by the fact that if, in normal times, the world's buyers of British goods were all to withhold their payments for as short a period as 2.5 months, the Bank of England's gold and dollar reserves would vanish. At the other end of the scale is the dealer in money who borrows pounds and then converts the loan into dollars. Such a dealer, instead of merely protecting his business interests, is engaging in an out-and-out speculative move called a short sale, hoping to buy back the pounds he owes more cheaply later on. He is simply trying to make a profit on the decrease in value he anticipates, and, what with the low commissions prevailing in the international money market, the maneuver provides one of the world's most attractive forms of high-stakes gambling. Gambling of this sort, although in fact it probably contributed far less to the sterling crisis than the self-protective measures taken by nervous importers and exporters, was being widely blamed for all the pound's troubles of October and November 1964. Particularly in the British Parliament, there were angry references to speculative activity by the gnomes of Zurich, Zurich being singled out because Switzerland, whose banking laws rigidly protect the anonymity of depositors, is the blind pig of international banking, and consequently, much currency speculation originating in many parts of the world is funneled through Zurich. Besides low commissions and anonymity, currency speculation has another attraction. Thanks to time differentials and good telephone service, the world money market, unlike stock exchanges, racetracks, and gambling casinos, practically never closes. London opens an hour after the continent, or did until February 1968, when Britain adopted continental time. New York 5, now 6 hours after that. San Francisco, 3 hours after that. And then Tokyo gets underway about the time San Francisco closes. Only a need for sleep, or a lack of money, need halt the operations of a really hopelessly addicted plunger anywhere. It was not the gnomes of Zurich who were beating down the pound, a leading Zurich banker subsequently maintained. stopping short of claiming that there were no gnomes there. Nonetheless, organized short selling, what traders call a bear raid, was certainly in progress, and the defenders of the pound in London and their sympathizers in New York would have given plenty to catch a glimpse of the invisible enemy. It was in this atmosphere, then, that on the weekend beginning November 7th, the leading central bankers of the world held their regular monthly gathering in Basel, Switzerland. The occasion for such gatherings, which have been held regularly since the 1930s, except during the Second World War, is the monthly meeting of the Board of Directors of the Bank for International Settlements, which was established in Basel in 1930, primarily as a clearinghouse for the handling of reparations payments arising out of the First World War, but has come to serve as an agency of international monetary cooperation and, incidentally, a kind of central bankers' club. As such, it is considerably more limited in resources and restricted as to membership than the International Monetary Fund. But, like other exclusive clubs, it is often the scene of great decisions. Represented on its board of directors are Britain, France, West Germany, Italy, Belgium, the Netherlands, Sweden, and Switzerland. In short, the economic powers of Western Europe. While the United States is a regular monthly guest whose presence is counted on, and Canada and Japan are less frequent visitors. The Federal Reserve is almost always represented by Coombs, and sometimes by Hayes, and other New York officers as well. In the nature of things, the interests of the different central banks conflict. Their faces are set against each other almost as if they were players in a poker game. Even so, in view of the fact that international troubles with money at their root have almost as long a history as similarly caused troubles between individuals, the most surprising thing about international monetary cooperation is that it is so new. Through all the ages prior to the First World War, it cannot be said to have existed at all. In the 1920s, it existed chiefly through close personal ties between individual central bankers, often maintained in spite of the indifference of their governments. On an official level, it got off to a halting start through the Financial Committee of the League of Nations, which was supposed to encourage joint action to prevent monetary catastrophes. The sterling collapse of 1931 and its grim sequel were ample proof of the committee's failure. But better days were ahead. The 1944 International Financial Conference at Bretton Woods, out of which emerged not only the International Monetary Fund, but also the whole structure of post-war monetary rules designed to help establish and maintain fixed exchange rates, as well as the World Bank, designed to ease the flow of money from rich countries to poor or war-devastated ones, stands as a milestone in economic cooperation comparable to the formation of the United Nations in political affairs. To cite just one of the conference's fruits, a credit of more than $1 billion extended to Britain by the International Monetary Fund during the Suez Affair in 1956 prevented a major international financial crisis then. In subsequent years, economic changes, like other changes, tended to come more and more quickly. After 1958, monetary crises began springing up virtually overnight, and the International Monetary Fund, which is hindered by slow-moving machinery, sometimes proved inadequate to meet such crises alone. Again, the new spirit of cooperation rose to the occasion, this time with the richest of nations, the United States, taking the lead. Starting in 1961, the Federal Reserve Bank, with the approval of the Federal Reserve Board and the Treasury in Washington, joined the other leading central banks in setting up a system of ever-ready revolving credits, which soon came to be called the swap network. The purpose of the network was to complement the International Monetary Fund's longer-term credit facilities by giving central banks instant access to funds they might need for a short period in order to move fast and vigorously in defense of their currencies. Its effectiveness was not long in being put to the test. Between its initiation in 1961 and the autumn of 1964, the SWAP network had played a major part in the triumphant defense against sudden and violent speculative attacks on at least three currencies. The pound, late in 1961, the Canadian dollar in June 1961, and the Italian lira in March 1964. By the autumn of 1964, the swap agreements, l'accord de swap, to the French, die Schwab verpflichtungen, to the Germans, had come to be the very cornerstone of international monetary cooperation. Indeed, the $500 million American dollars that the Bank of England was finding it necessary to draw on at the very moment the bank's top officers were heading for Basel that November weekend represented part of the swap network, greatly expanded from its comparatively modest beginnings. As for the Bank for International Settlements, in its capacity as a banking institution, it was a relatively minor cog in all this machinery. But in its capacity as a club, it had over the years come to play a far from unimportant role. Its monthly board meetings served, and still serve, as a chance for the central bankers to talk in an informal atmosphere, to exchange gossip, views, and hunches such as could not comfortably be indulged in either by mail or over the international telephone circuits. Basel, a medieval Rhenish city that is dominated by the spires of its 12th-century Gothic cathedral and has long been a thriving center of the chemical industry, was originally chosen as the site of the Bank for International Settlements because it was a nodal point for European railways. Now that most international bankers habitually travel by plane, that asset has become a liability, for there is no long-distance air service to Basel. Delegates must deplane at Zurich and continue by train or car. On the other hand, Basel has several first-rate restaurants, and it may be that in the view of the central bank delegates, this advantage outweighs the travel inconvenience. For central banking, or at least European central banking, has a firmly established association with good living. A governor of the National Bank of Belgium once remarked to a visitor, without a smile, that he considered one of his duties to be that of leaving the institution's wine cellar better than he had found it. A luncheon guest at the Bank of France is generally told, apologetically, "In the tradition of the bank, we serve only simple fare." But what follows is a repast during which the constant discussion of vintages makes any discussion of banking awkward, if not impossible, and at which the tradition of simplicity is honored, apparently, by the serving of only one wine before the cognac. The table of the Bank of Italy is equally elegant, some say the best in Rome, and its surroundings are enhanced by the priceless Renaissance paintings, acquired as defaulted security on bad loans over the years, that hang on the walls. As for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, alcohol in any form is hardly ever served there. Banking is habitually discussed at meals, and the mistress of the kitchen appears almost pathetically grateful whenever one of the officers makes any sort of comment, even a critical one, on the fare. But then Liberty Street isn't Europe. In these democratic times, central banking in Europe is thought of as the last stronghold of the aristocratic banking tradition, in which wit, grace, and culture coexist easily with commercial astuteness and even ruthlessness. The European counterparts of the security guards on Liberty Street are apt to be attendants in morning coats. Until less than a generation ago, formality of address between central bankers was the rule. Some think that the first to break it were the British during the Second World War, when, it is alleged, a secret order went out that British government and military authorities were to address their American counterparts by their first names. In any event, first names are frequently exchanged between European and American central bankers now, and one reason for this, unquestionably, is the post-war rise in influence of the dollar. Another reason is that in the emerging era of cooperation, the central bankers see more of each other than they used to. Not just in Basel, but in Washington, Paris, and Brussels, at regular meetings of perhaps half a dozen special banking committees of various international organizations. The same handful of top bankers parades so regularly through the hotel lobbies of those cities that one of them thinks they must give the impression of being 100 strong, like the spear carriers who cross the stage again and again in the triumphal scene of Aida. And language, like the manner of its use, has tended to follow economic power. European central bankers have always used French, bad French, some say, in talking with each other. But during the long period in which the pound was the world's leading currency, English came to be the first language of central banking at large. And under the rule of the dollar, it continues to be. It is spoken fluently and willingly by all the top officers of every central bank except the Bank of France. And even the Bank of France officers are forced to keep translators at hand in consideration of the seeming intractable inability or unwillingness of most Britons and Americans to become competent in any language but their own. Lord Cromer, flouting tradition, speaks French with complete authority. At Basel, good food and convenience come before splendor. Many of the delegates favor an outwardly humble restaurant in the main railroad station, and the Bank for International Settlements itself is modestly situated between a tea shop and a hairdressing establishment. On that November weekend in 1964, Vice President Coombs was the only representative of the Federal Reserve System on hand, and indeed, he was to be the key banking representative of the United States through the early and middle phases of the crisis that was then mounting. In an abstracted way, Coombs ate and drank heartily with the others. True to his institution's traditions, he is less than a gourmet. But his real interest was in getting the sense of the meeting and the private feelings of its participants. He was the perfect man for this task, inasmuch as he has the unquestioning trust and respect of all his foreign colleagues. The other leading central bankers habitually call him by his first name, less, it seems, in deference to changed custom than out of deep affection and admiration. They also use it in speaking of him among themselves. The name Charlie Coombs, run together thus out of long habituation, is a word to conjure with in central banking circles. Charlie Coombs, they will tell you, is the kind of New Englander, he is from Newton, Massachusetts, who, although his clipped speech and dry manner make him seem a bit cool and detached, is really warm and intuitive. Charlie Coombs, although a Harvard graduate, class of 1940, is the kind of unpretentious, gray-haired man with half-rimmed spectacles and a precise manner whom you might easily take for a standard American small-town bank president, rather than a master of one of the world's most complex skills. It is generally conceded that if any one man was the genius behind the swap network, the man was the New England swapper, Charlie Coombs. At Basel, there was, as usual, a series of formal sessions, each with its agenda. But there was also, as usual, much informal palaver in rump sessions held in hotel rooms and offices, and at a formal Sunday night dinner, at which there was no agenda, but instead a free discussion of what Coombs has since referred to as the hottest topic of the moment. There could be no question about what that was. It was the condition of the pound, and indeed Coombs had heard little discussion of anything else all weekend. It was clear to me, from what I heard, that confidence in sterling was deteriorating, he has said. Two questions were on most of the bankers' minds. One was whether the Bank of England proposed to take some of the pressure off the pound by raising its lending rate. Bank of England men were present, but getting an answer was not a simple matter of asking them their intentions. Even if they had been willing to say, they would not have been able to, because the Bank of England is not empowered to change its rate without the approval, which in practice often comes closer to meaning the instruction of the British government, and elected governments have a natural dislike for measures that make money tight. The other question was whether Britain had enough gold and dollars to throw into the breach if the speculative assault should continue. Apart from what was left of the $1 billion from the expanded swap network and what remained of its drawing rights on the International Monetary Fund, Britain had only its official reserves, which had dropped in the previous week to something under $2.5 billion, their lowest point in several years. Worse than that was the frightful rate at which the reserves were dwindling away. On a single bad day during the previous week, according to the guesses of experts, they had dropped by $87 million. A month of days like that, and they would be gone. Even so, Coombs has said, nobody at Basel that weekend dreamed that the pressure on sterling could become as intense as it actually did become later in the month. He returned to New York worried but resolute. It was not to New York, however, that the main scene of the battle for sterling shifted after the Basel meeting. It was to London. The big immediate question was whether or not Britain would raise its bank rate that week, and the day the answer would be known was Thursday, November 12th. In the matter of the bank rate, as in so many other things, the British customarily follow a ritual. If there is to be a change at noon on Thursday, then and then only, a sign appears in the ground floor lobby of the Bank of England announcing the new rate, and, simultaneously, a functionary called the government broker, decked out in a pink coat and top hat, hurries down Throgmorton Street to the London Stock Exchange and ceremonially announces the new rate from a rostrum. Noon on Thursday the 12th passed with no change. Evidently, the Labour government was having as much trouble deciding on a bank rate rise after the election as the Conservatives had had before. The speculators, wherever they were, reacted to such pusillanimity as one man. On Friday the 13th, the pound, which had been moderately buoyant all week precisely because speculators had been anticipating a bank rate rise, underwent a fearful battering, which sent it down to a closing price of $2.78 and 29 hundredths of a cent, barely more than a quarter of a cent above the official minimum. And the Bank of England, intervening frequently to hold it even at that level, lost $28 million more from its reserves. Next day, the financial commentator of the London Times, under the byline, "Our City Editor," let himself go. "The pound," he wrote, "is not looking as firm as might be hoped." The following week saw the pattern repeated, but in exaggerated form. On Monday, Prime Minister Wilson, taking a leaf out of Winston Churchill's book, tried rhetoric as a weapon. Speaking at a pomp and circumstance banquet at the Guildhall in the City of London before an audience that included, among many other dignitaries, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Lord Chancellor, the Lord President of the Council, the Lord Privy Seal, the Lord Mayor of London, and their wives, Wilson ringingly proclaimed, "Not only our faith but our determination to keep sterling strong and to see it riding high," and asserted that the government would not hesitate to take whatever steps might become necessary to accomplish this purpose. While elaborately avoiding the dread word devaluation, just as all other British officials had avoided it all summer, Wilson sought to make it unmistakable that the government now considered such a move out of the question. To emphasize this point, he included a warning to speculators: "If anyone at home or abroad doubts the firmness of our resolve, let them be prepared to pay the price for their lack of faith in Britain." Perhaps the speculators were daunted by this verbal volley, or perhaps they were again moved to let up in their assault on the pound by the prospect of a bank rate rise on Thursday. In any case, on Tuesday and Wednesday, the pound, though it hardly rode high in the marketplace, managed to ride a little less low than it had on the previous Friday, and to do so without the help of the Bank of England. By Thursday, according to subsequent reports, a sharp private dispute had erupted between the Bank of England and the British government on the bank rate question. Lord Cromer arguing for the bank that a rise of at least 1% and perhaps 2% was absolutely essential, and Wilson, Brown, and Callahan still demurring. The upshot was no bank rate rise on Thursday, and the effect of the inaction was a swift intensification of the crisis. Friday the 20th was a black day in the City of London. The Stock Exchange, its investors moving in time with Sterling, had a terrible session. The Bank of England had by now resolved to establish its last line trench on the pound at $2.78 and 25/100ths of a cent, a quarter of a cent above the bottom limit. The pound opened on Friday at precisely that level and remained there all day, firmly pinned down by the speculators' hail of offers to sell. Meanwhile, the bank met all offers at $2.78 and 25/100ths of a cent, and in doing so, used up more of Britain's reserves. Now the offers were coming so fast that little attempt was made to disguise their places of origin. It was evident that they were coming from everywhere, chiefly from the financial centers of Europe, but also from New York, and even from London itself. Rumors of imminent devaluation were sweeping the bourses of the continent, and in London itself an ominous sign of cracking morale appeared. Devaluation was now being mentioned openly even there. The Swedish economist and sociologist Gunnar Myrdal, in a luncheon speech in London on Thursday, had suggested that a slight devaluation might now be the only possible solution to Britain's problems. Once a exogenous comment had broken the ice, Britons also began using the dread word, and in the next morning's Times, our city editor himself was to say, in the tone of a commander preparing the garrison for possible surrender, "Indiscriminate gossip about devaluation of the pound can do harm, but it would be even worse to regard use of that word as taboo." When nightfall at last brought the pound and its defenders a weekend breather, the Bank of England had a chance to assess its situation. What it found was anything but reassuring. All but a fraction of the $1 billion it had arranged to borrow in September under the expanded swap agreements had gone into the battle. The right that remained to it of drawing on the International Monetary Fund was virtually worthless, since the transaction would take weeks to complete and matters turned on days and hours. What the bank still had, and all that it had, was the British reserves, which had gone down by $56 million that day and now stood at around $2 billion. More than one commentator has since suggested that this sum could, in a way, be likened to the few squadrons of fighter planes to which the same dogged nation had been reduced 24 years earlier at the worst point in the Battle of Britain. The analogy is extravagant, and yet in the light of what the pound means and has meant to the British, it is not irrelevant. In a materialistic age, the pound is almost the symbolic importance that was once accorded to the crown. The state of Sterling almost is the state of Britain. The pound is the oldest of modern currencies. The term pound sterling is believed to have originated well before the Norman conquest, when the Saxon kings issued silver pennies called sterlings or starlings, because they sometimes had stars inscribed on them, of which 240 equaled 1 pound of pure silver. The shilling, representing 12 sterlings, or 1/20th of a pound, did not appear on the scene until after the conquest. Thus, sizable payments in Britain have been reckoned in pounds from its beginnings. The pound, however, was by no means an unassailably sound currency during its first few centuries, chiefly because of the early king's unfortunate habit of relieving their chronic financial embarrassment by debasing the coinage. By melting down a quantity of sterlings, adding to the brew some base metal and no more silver, and then minting new coins, an irresponsible king could magically convert £100 into, say, 110, just like that. Queen Elizabeth I put a stop to the practice when, in a carefully planned surprise move in 1561, she recalled from circulation all the debased coins issued by her predecessors. The result, combined with the growth of British trade, was a rapid and spectacular rise in the prestige of the pound. And less than a century after Elizabeth's coup, the word sterling had assumed the adjectival meaning that it still has. Thoroughly excellent, capable of standing every test. By the end of the 17th century, when the Bank of England was founded to handle the government's finances, paper money was beginning to be trusted for general use, and it had come to be backed by gold as well as silver. As time went on, the monetary prestige of gold rose steadily in relation to that of silver. In the modern world, silver has no standing as a monetary reserve metal, and only in some half-dozen countries does it now serve as the principal metal in subsidiary coinage. But it was not until 1816 that Britain adopted a gold standard. That is, pledged itself to redeem paper currency with gold coins or bars at any time. The gold sovereign, worth £1, which came to symbolize stability, affluence, and even joy, to more Victorians than Bagehot, made its first appearance in 1817. Prosperity begat emulation. Seeing how Britain flourished, and believing the gold standard to be at least partly responsible, other nations adopted it one after another. Germany in 1871. Sweden, Norway, and Denmark in 1873. France, Belgium, Switzerland, Italy, and Greece in 1874. The Netherlands in 1875, and the United States in 1879. The results were disappointing. Hardly any of the newcomers found themselves immediately getting rich. And Britain, which in retrospect appears to have flourished as much in spite of the gold standard as because of it, continued to be the undisputed monarch of world trade. In the half-century preceding the First World War, London was the middleman in international finance.